Let's begin. Thank you for coming. This talk may have seemed like it has a title intended to entice you here under the pretense that I'm going to be fomenting a rebellion or something here. I was hoping that would increase turnout. But it is a Latin talk. I think it'll be a Latin talk that is interesting for all of you, whether or not you do have the intention of hiring Latin teachers or actually teaching Latin yourself, or simply an intrigued parent. But before I tell you why I think you and your students should study Latin, allow me to tell you a story about how I first came to study it. Picture, if you will, a suburban home in Maryland on a Saturday morning in 1987. At the crack of dawn, two brothers, ages 7 and 11, quietly drag a gigantic box full of He-Man and the Masters of the Universe figures from a bedroom to the family room at the other end of the house, where they will engage in an epic plastic battle of good versus evil before their parents even think about getting up. The boys attend local, reputable public schools in an era predating the classical Christian school movement. They spend their school days filling out mindless worksheets while being subtly indoctrinated with the lies of secularism and multiculturalism. Not surprisingly, they get pretty good grades in an environment devoid of challenge. While in the family room, Skeletor and Beastman are plotting to usurp the rule of Eternia from King Randor and the Sorceress, the mother of this family of four stirs in her bed. It's nearly 7 in the morning on a weekend in June. Why is she restless? And then it hits her. She's worried about the education of her sons. Before settling down in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., with her husband to be a homemaker and to raise these two kids, she was a high school teacher in the Midwest. And even then, she could see what was becoming of the government's education system. The grammar of English was taught less and less, and it was increasingly unlikely that her sons would ever learn to diagram a sentence or to study the Greco-Roman roots of Western civilization. As a classics major in college, not only had language and history come alive for her, but she had met my father. Nothing had intrigued or challenged her in school before Latin, but it opened up entirely new vistas of learning. History, mythology, and great literature all presented on the platter of one dead language. In a culture increasingly obsessed with modernity, postmodernity, and the technical skills necessary to keep up, would her boys ever get to taste the fruit of this language? Or perhaps a dead language produces not a fruit, but a fine fungus. A portobello mushroom, perhaps. In any event, she put her foot down just in time. Saturday mornings would never be the same for these two boys. For that matter, no day would ever be the same. For every day until these boys entered high school, save for Christmas and Easter, this mother would require a half an hour of Latin study. The 7-year-old learned the terms nominative and accusative right alongside the subject and direct object in English. He learned who Julius Caesar was before he knew who Ronald Reagan was. He was learning Latin before he had ever heard of French or Spanish. And it was hard. You can hear her tell stories to this day of how both boys, but especially the older one, dragged their feet, not me, and wailed about the torture and singular pain that none of their friends had to cope with. All these histrionics, despite the fact that we were never formally tested or quizzed, but she always made me look up a word when I didn't know it. She never gave it away. That's kind of annoying. And so, while the public schools taught her sons the things that she couldn't, math, science, music, she spent a little time at home every day to teach them the language, history, and culture of the ancient Romans. At the same time, without really even trying, she taught them the value of hard work, perseverance, and delayed gratification. The language itself taught them the importance of diligence and precise thinking. At Rockridge Academy, where I teach, our illustrious headmaster sitting over there, Michael McKenna, is fond of quoting the words of Christ in Luke 6:40, that a student, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. He uses this passage to impress upon us what a staggering, sobering task it is to raise up children. We should never take our calling as teachers lightly. My brother and I both came to love the classics, loving what our mother had loved before us and right there in front of us. Despite some efforts to study some other things in college, and despite the encouragement of our parents to pursue more practical things, the two of us were unable to resist the pull of classical languages. Our mother had done her job too well. My brother would eventually use Latin as a launching pad to study the Greek language and Greek philosophy, and from there, he developed a real thirst for biblical scholarship and Christian theology. On the other hand, I pretty much stuck with what Mom had taught me. But we ended up at the same place in life. God would eventually place it on both of our hearts to teach in classical Christian schools. My brother Matt Baldwin teaches at Mars Hill Academy in Cincinnati and spoke here several years ago, actually right here in Atlanta, or maybe it was Covington, I'm not sure. And it never happens if God doesn't move my mother to change the way her children were educated 20 years ago. So this is a short version of why I studied Latin. I was saved by the concern and long-term vision of a mother worried about her son's education. I freely admit that Latin is not something that I would have been drawn to otherwise. When I would drag my feet as a fourth or a fifth grader, my mother would often plead with me, "Just think of how good it will feel when you're done today." The same argument can be made for beating one's head against the wall. "Feels so good when I stop." And that argument actually worked fairly well until one day, probably seventh or eighth grade, I was mature enough to admit that I actually enjoyed the challenges of Latin because I was finally reaping the fruit or harvesting those mushrooms. And so it is now for me as a teacher. Seek out a Rockbridge student and ask him what his favorite class is. And the chances are he'll only say Latin if he's extremely young and still charmed by its novelty and mystery, or in his final year enjoying Latin literature translation at last. Very rare is the young student who can find unbridled joy in vocabulary flashcards and relatively simplistic sentence structures in those mid-years. My point here is that Latin is not a subject that students will pick if presented with a buffet of subjects. People who know better need to make it mandatory. And surely you've noticed that Latin continues to be a subject for which schools and their teachers are perpetually apologizing. Why study Latin indeed? Isn't there something better we could be doing with the students' time? Nobody speaks Latin. The students won't even speak it in the true conversational sense when they completed their high school studies, so that may be changing. Why not teach them a language they can put to use immediately? Usually then come the arguments for Spanish, Chinese, and Arabic. Don't the students need one of these languages to impact the culture for Christ in the 21st century? I would say the answer is absolutely not. And even if the answer is maybe, who says the child cannot pursue these languages at a later time? The culture in general doesn't get it. And when faced with a scoffer I've just met, I've usually trotted out the classic, quick, and easy-to-digest arguments for Latin. Approximately 65% of the English dictionary is rooted in Latin. Students who take Latin score markedly higher on the verbal sections of standardized tests than those who don't. In fact, the students who scored the highest on the verbal section of the GRE are students who majored in classics, not those who majored in English. Latin paves the way, lexically and grammatically, for the study of numerous languages that evolved from it, and for just as many that didn't. Many of the mysteries of English grammar are instantly solved. When to use who, and when to use whom. As a Latin teacher, though, these are not the arguments that I firmly believe in, but they are the ground fire that I lay down before I summon the only argument that should matter. There's an intrinsic value to studying Latin. That is to say, reading Latin is its own reward. When we teach Latin merely as a tool to attain some other tangential goals, we sell the language short. Just as calculus is the rhetoric of math, and any math teacher feels let down when a capable student declines to pursue their mathematical studies to the end, so does a Latin teacher cringe to think of a student suffering under the weight of countless flashcards and grammatical jargon, only to stop short of reading and analyzing Caesar, Cicero, Ovid, and Virgil. To read these authors in English is to miss out on a world of nuance. To be a high-level Latin scholar is to read Latin authors in Latin. Can we imagine a respected biblical scholar who knows nothing of Greek or of Hebrew? There's simply nothing more satisfying in all of Latin than synthesizing that tricky grammar and that pesky vocabulary to unlock the meaning of an ancient text. Looking back on my Latin career, the ability to read and interpret classical Latin literature is the only reward I ever needed. Perhaps what gives so many Christians doubts about the value of Latin is that, on the face of it, it doesn't appear to be a Christian pursuit. And here in American culture, at least, this is largely true. Many Latin majors I met in college loved the language for the very fact that it was the tongue of the last great pagan culture. Latin and the associated study of Roman culture was a chance for these students to celebrate man's greatness in a time before the advent of the gospel. What they may not have realized was that Christianity sprang up from within and took over the Roman Empire. Thus, the roots of the church itself are Latin, and its organization mimicked the organization of the church. And since medieval universities sprang out of the church, Latin remained the language of the church and of academia for thousands of years. The National Junior Classical League, or the NJCL, to which I belonged as a high school student, has the noble goal of acquainting its members with the languages and cultures of classical civilization. At many schools, including the ones that I went to, it was merely an excuse to be in a club that dressed up in togas and took a once-a-year trip to Six Flags. Where is Christ in all of this? The short answer is that Christ does not shine through to the students in Latin unless the instructor makes it a focus. Nearly every morning at faculty prayer, we pray that Christ and his gospel would shine forth in our teaching. In Latin, this is a particular challenge for me. I know there are students in my classroom who cannot see Christ in the subjunctive mood and the appellative absolute. To combat this potentially depressing view of Latin, I take every opportunity to make it clear to the students that there's a twofold reason why they are learning Latin. Number one, to read Latin literature. Eventually, trust me. And number two, to serve the Lord Christ better in their future callings. No other class a student can take combines precise linguistic skills, intensely logical patterns of thinking, and a cultural understanding of the world at the time of Christ. I direct your attention back to the top of your outline and the quote from former UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld. Respect for the word, to employ it with scrupulous care, and an incorruptible, heartfelt love of the truth is essential if there is to be any growth in a society or in the human race. I don't know if Mr. Hammarskjöld was a professing Christian, but he certainly understood much about the potential abuse of language and the great boon of using it well and for good. If Latin teaches our students one thing above all else, it's just that. Words are the foundation of communication, written and oral. Language is not something to be used carelessly. How many dead-end arguments on blogs and chat rooms are perpetuated because one or both parties cannot understand each other, cannot even properly define their own terms? How many policies are made on a national level that lead nowhere or someplace worse because of a refusal to speak clearly and with conviction? At the end of the day, classical Christian schools desire to produce students ready to leave the classroom and fight for the cause of Christ on the cultural battlefield. And this conquest starts with the skills of language. How can our students stand before kings unless they have the confidence that what they're saying is not only winsomely worded, but true as well? And for that matter, how can they stand before kings if they're putting the pronoun in the subject case after a preposition? Just between you and I. Latin matures their thinking about language, delights their imagination with its literature, and equips them in numerous ways to serve Christ, whatever their calling. While I would argue that the ultimate goal of Latin is to read Latin literature, the perspective that the student gains on all areas of God's creation is invaluable. What I'd like to do now is take you on a tour of the ways that Latin works to enlighten and reinforce several other disciplines. As emphatically as I state that Latin is a language to be pursued on its own merits, it's no less true that it offers fringe benefits like no other subject can. Let's consider first the concept of definition. Perhaps nothing is more central to the study of logic, and therefore to the study of thinking and arguing, than definition. Very early in their study of logic, students learn the terms definiens, a Latin present active participle, translated as the thing the defining thing, or the thing defining, and definiendum, a future passive participle, translated as the thing to be defined. But years before they even take logic, Latin is often the first opportunity that my students have to consider that a word can have a wide spectrum of meanings. Consider the Latin verb gero, G-E-R-O, commonly defined as to manage, conduct, and bear. Soon after learning a word with several meanings, which is most of the words on their sheets when they're in third or fourth grade, it's not long before they're asking you, the teacher, Mr. Colvin, could the Romans use gero like this? Because they say, gero et gero, to mean I manage and I conduct. And the student always seems gravely disappointed when you tell them that they can't expect the Romans to be that clever. They do learn one lesson very quickly. The meaning of a word is very much dependent on the context in which it's used. One word matters a great deal to the meaning of another word, and the sentence must be considered as a whole. I recall my brother telling me of a Latin passage that he was preparing to read with his first or second year students that included the word solium, S-O-L-I-U-M, which under different circumstances can mean bathtub or throne. Needless to say, that's a word you cannot afford to be careless with. With some more Latin translation experience, the student learns that the meaning of a word can change through history. A word that Cicero uses, okay, talking 60, 50, mid-40s BC, may mean something else entirely when used by Pliny 150 years later. In other words, definitions are historically contextualized. To determine the definition of a word, a student has to, in some sense, become his own lexicographer. Students often ask me, how do we know what every Latin word can mean? When I show them the Lewis and Short Latin lexicon, which I couldn't pack because it would have cost too much, right? Gigantic hardback book, cost over $150. There goes the teacher book allowance. They become wide-eyed when they see this thing. Yes, some very learned people scoured all of Latin literature and cataloged each distinct way of using every word. It's not long before students realize that memorizing one meaning for gero is not going to get the job done. Not unless they want to wage a toga or wear a war. Reading Latin is difficult, and pinning down flexible definitions is of primary importance. The more experience a student has practicing definitional refinement in Latin, the more conscientious he will be in speaking his own native tongue. And no discussion of Latin and definition can be complete without considering the great aid that Latin is to determining the meaning of unfamiliar words in English. But that's dangerously close to talking about the improved scores on the SAT and all that. Let's not go there. At Rockbridge Academy, Latin instruction comes to an end in the 10th grade, and the instructional void is filled the next year by formal training in rhetoric, which lasts through the student's senior year. While it's always sad for me to stop reading Latin with my 10th graders when they're at the height of their competency, I feel that their transition from Latin to rhetoric is a natural and logical one. My brother Matt tells a story of his first year teaching, writing at Cornell University. Before teaching the class, he was assigned to read an article that divided grammar into several categories, and which suggested that prescriptive grammar, and I quote now, is dependent on artificial and obsolete Latin-based rules, and is a tool of social stratification and oppression. Ooh. And when he entered his freshman classroom, he was surprised to find a large number of practically illiterate students, all eager to learn grammar so they could write well, but he was forbidden to do so, since he had been instructed to concentrate on thesis and argument. And yet no one will succeed in constructing an argued thesis until grammar and diction are automatic. The grammar and vocabulary of Latin serve as a magnificent buttress to their counterparts in English. Our grammar is largely based on Latin, and there's no reason to be ashamed of it. While most schools that teach rhetoric will read Cicero and Quintilian to some degree in English, rarely will they read these men in the original Latin. Not surprisingly, there are some rhetorical effects that Cicero can only produce in Latin. While the work of some Latin poets can be turned into some fairly lovely poetry in English, translation does not come close to doing Cicero justice. A prime example of Cicero's rhetorical mastery is his periodic sentence. A periodic sentence is a lengthy sentence, and your students will complain, very lengthy, that presents its subject early on, first word in the first three words, but through a lengthy array of objects, modifiers, and clauses, it withholds the main verb, and therefore the emotional punch, until the very end of the sentence. This is why Latin students new to Cicero generally do not like him. Okay, they hate him. But it's a beautiful way to teach students the careful technique of translation. In a periodic sentence, all hope of depending on word order for meaning is cruelly snatched away. The meaning hinges on the reader's ability to group together clauses that are parallel and interpret every word according to its inflected ending. Once you understand Cicero's goal and the grammar he employs, the effect is staggering. The Greek critic Longinus compares Cicero's periodic style to a fire raging upon a plain, continually extending itself and gathering strength as it spreads. Besides this magnificent periodic sentence, Cicero boasts a host of rhetorical devices that either have no comparison in English or have a much weaker effect. Chiasmus, endiadys, hyperbaton, hysteron proteron, prolepsis, and zeugma, to name a few, and really cool names, but they're Greek. What a delight for the student to see the master rhetorician dominate on his home field, Latin, so to speak. And as my mother said when she was training me to write papers in English, just write them like Cicero did. Group your ideas in threes and use plenty of parallel structures. Let's turn now to history. To study Latin literature is to study Roman history at its most exciting and tumultuous. It's always been a great consternation to me as a film buff that no one has made a movie of exceptional quality centered on the power struggles of the first century BC Roman Republic. This is debatable, but to me, they have not. With men like Sulla, Marius, Pompey, Caesar, and Cicero stalking the political stage, the best we can muster is a couple of now severely dated takes on the lives of Spartacus and Cleopatra. So be it. The cinema is probably low on the list of things we need to be concerned with reforming. But the student who reads Golden Age Latin is thrust into the midst of this period of history. Have we ever stopped to think how historically convenient it is that nearly all the important Roman authors were also leading politicians, on the payroll of leading politicians, or in trouble with leading politicians? A Roman literature survey course from 100 BC to 100 AD could double as a history course for the same period. To understand the workings of the empire at the time of Christ is of great importance if we are to understand the culture among which Jesus walked and the apostles spread the gospel. Think also of the founding fathers, men who are intimately familiar with Roman history. They viewed the democracy of Athens as a horrible example, and the Roman Republic as a generally good one. And so we have a government with a balance of powers, with a Senate rather than a House of Lords, with presidents who resemble consuls in many respects, and with vetoes and threats of vetoes to help balance things out. It's impossible to read Caesar and Cicero and not talk of this political heritage. Upon closer inspection, history comes alive even in the actual words of the Latin language. We see the agrarian roots of Rome in words such as pecunia, money, and colo, colore, coli, cultum, to worship, words which originally dealt with cattle and the tilling of the earth, respectively. And surely you've heard how the Eskimos have thousands of words for snow. That statement may or may not be completely false, but the Romans are approaching that number with different ways to capture the idea of killing. Caedo, concido, conficio, consumo, corporo, deigio, epligo, extinguo, ferio, interficio, interino, interneco, jugulo, leto, macto, mortifico, neco, obtrunco, occido, percutio, perino, perneco, persolo, restinguo, socio, sisto, socio, strangulo, sopico, sumito, tolo, trucido, trunco. I found those in 5 minutes of research. What might this say about their culture and their history? All right, what does Latin have in common with mathematics? and therefore with science, whose language is mathematics. Well, I just said it. They're both languages. It's no surprise that in almost every case, a student who struggles in Latin will also struggle in math. Unfortunately, I have no proof that Latin is a way to break down the mind's resistance to the logical, cumulative processes of mathematics, thus making it easier to learn math. But both languages are mercilessly... Both languages are mercilessly cumulative and logical, which is actually a considerable mercy in the long run. Better to be that than mercilessly non-cumulative and completely illogical. So while a lazy lit student can fail the unit on A Tale of Two Cities in October and start paying attention again for The Count of Monte Cristo in the spring, there's no such allowance for daydreaming in math or Latin. And while no less of an excellent argument can be made for Greek, think of the value of Latin in demystifying terms like transversal, abscissa, cardinal, conjugate, exponent, fraction, obtuse and acute, quadrilateral, secant, sequence, subtract, and vector. And finally, when I read Latin with my students in the classroom, and this one could be the real stretch here, but bear with me, I use math analogies. What some grammarians refer to as gapping, the omission of a previously stated term in the second half of a conjoined sentence, for instance, Jack prefers Latin and Jill Greek. The word prefers is gone in the second half. This is very similar to the distributive property in math. I make sure to show the students the imaginary parentheses, and they groan in appreciation because they thought that math was over last period. And so while I cannot say that Latin is a key to understanding math, I do know that the similarities between the two languages make the other one more understandable. QED. Quote out of Emmons Condos. Let's move on to literature. By the 10th grade at our school, Latin has become a literature course. It's just really challenging to read. It's fascinating to see students forced to go beyond their comfort zone in Latin when they really start digging deep into the Golden Age authors. Some of them have been content to live in a world of declensional endings and principal parts. And now I'm gently nudging them into a new arena of grand literary themes, heroes and anti-heroes, love and vengeance, political intrigue, and delicate poetic devices. The vast array of mythology that we read from Ovid not only gives a student a more decorated and lofty view of the myths they may have read as children, but also fills in gaps when they go on to read Dante's Inferno or John Milton's Paradise Lost. And surely we're all familiar with how Shakespeare plunders classical literature and history to marvelous effect, bringing to life Coriolanus, Julius Caesar, and Mark Antony, and beautifully reworking Roman yarns into Romeo and Juliet and A Comedy of Errors. And finally, theology and philosophy. How does Latin enhance the Christian's ability to appreciate these glorious studies? The most immediate way is in the general sharpening of the mind that I've already mentioned in the definition and rhetoric sections. Latin students are readier than the average bear to think about what a word means and what a word doesn't mean. They understand the fundamental difference between classical languages and modern languages. They understand when a biblical scholar is blowing smoke because of his ignorance of the perfect tense. And while not a direct application of Latin, the Latin student is more prepared than anyone to approach a study of Greek and Hebrew. Learning Greek without a prior knowledge of Latin is something that happens fairly commonly here in America, particularly in seminaries and colleges like St. John's in Annapolis. But my heart goes out to every student who's ever been compelled to learn an inflected language in a different alphabet. And while the student who has learned Latin but no Greek may be shut off from fully appreciating Plato and Aristotle, he has access to Lucretius, Cicero, Seneca, the Church Fathers, and the Protestant Reformers. I talked to my mother last week about what she envisioned her sons doing when they grew up, way back in the 80s when she first started this. And her answer was not surprising, but it was more than a little amusing. She said, "I knew that whatever you did, you'd be prepared to think better, speak better, and write better than most candidates for the job." And she added, "In my experience, someone is always hiring a Latin teacher." I think if you look at the board out there, Tall Oaks is looking for one, and school in Oklahoma, I don't remember what it was called, some new prep school perhaps. So I like to think that I don't fall into the category of those who can't teach. And I sometimes think about what I would be doing if I weren't teaching Latin. And every profession that even crosses my mind for a second, from sports journalist to judge to lobbyist to stand-up comic, failed stand-up comic, to lexicographer, I know I would do a better job with Latin than without. Students who graduate from classical Christian schools will pursue all kinds of careers. We don't pretend to be factories that churn out theologians and teachers. One day, if not already, we will produce a professional race car driver, a concert violinist, an actor, a pilot, and a cartoonist. And of course, we will produce homemakers, husbands, wives, pastors, missionaries, lawyers, and politicians. And some of these graduates may spend most of their day thinking, speaking, and writing. And some will spend most of their day driving really fast in a circle or drawing caricatures of the president. But whatever they do from 9 to 5, they're all called to love Christ with their minds, to raise up their children in the fear and admonition of the Lord, and to search the scriptures. All these actions require us to think clearly and to craft our words with care. The lexical and grammatical precision of Latin is a wonderful way for us to become clearer thinkers and communicators, and as such, better equipped to present Christ to the world. Latin is for every Christian who will ever attend a Bible study, write a paper, speak in front of an audience, share the gospel with a family member or stranger, or listen to a sermon. I'd like to close with a quote from Mary Beard and John Henderson, professors at Cambridge. It is well known that old-fashioned schools used to drill the children of the rich in Latin grammar. 100 years ago, in most British public schools, not much was taught except Latin and Greek. The justification for this was not principally the excitement of the ancient literature that was opened up to a pupil who could read the languages fluently, but the habits of logical rationality that were supposedly inculcated from the careful learning of all the grammatical rules. A minor Victorian industry lay in producing textbooks, some still in use today, to explain the finer points of these rules, to name and describe the grammatical parts, the gerund and gerundive, amoa maxima, the ablative absolute, the indirect statement, the supine stem of confiteor, the conditional sentence in oratio obliqua, me verbs, the third person singular pluperfect passive subjunctive of the fourth conjugation. Only a lunatic fringe now believes that the learning of grammatical rules has any positive effect on a pupil's logical thinking. Join me on that lunatic fringe, would you? Thank you. I'm going to speak tomorrow more on how we teach Latin at my school, so I'd like to refrain from answering questions about that then, rather now, but to do it then after that particular presentation. But certainly questions now are welcome. Yes?
The school is going to offer Latin for 3 years. What's 3 grades up?
Well, it seems to me that if you're going to offer Latin for 3 years, then I'm guessing that you're not going to be reading the great golden age authors at the end of the third one, and if you are, then you're awesome. Gotcha. Then I would recommend doing it as early as possible, or as early as feasible. Certainly third grade would be a fine place to start. That's when I started, and I was a dumb child. I kid you not. We spent probably 3 or 4 years on Latin 1 textbooks before we actually got things really, really churning. My mom wanted to make sure that I really got it early on. So, you know, I don't tell my students that, but I have deep sympathy for them when they're really struggling with the basics. But I think third grade's reasonable. And then have it all done by 7th in your plan. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Good question.
I heard most of the important features of that question. They were, as the young student is working on vocabulary memorization and chants and endings and such, when is the right time to start really working on translation? And I would say that it's never too early to start working on translation, be it in a simplified version. But you can't do a child a true disservice by starting with really simple translation. We're trying to make more efforts at our school to make the translation more involving at a really younger age. But certainly I would start right at the beginning with short sentences that can teach the kid that there's far more to this language than chanting endings and helping out your English vocabulary. And as they can start to see that it will eventually develop into something grand, something really challenging and worth studying. If they get that at a third grade level, that's great. Okay, thank you. I'll stay up here for a while afterwards to talk to you. If you want to come up with some questions later, thanks.